This is Haunted America with your host, Josh Mantello, and Al Shepard on Blog Talk Radio. To discuss today's topics, call 646-716-5896. And now, Haunted America with Josh Mantello and Al Shepard.
Hello, everyone. Once again to another episode of Haunted America Radio. My name's Al Shepard, and I am joined by my co-host, Josh Mantello. Hello, Josh.
Hello. We made it with 5 seconds to spare.
Yeah, I was pulling your stunts this week here. We were both here, but my audio wasn't working, so I didn't know if it's going to be a one-man show or what. Before I forget, I want to remind people next week's show, August 2nd, is the anniversary of the death of Wild Bill Hickok. So with that, we're going to have a Wild West show. I got a couple people going to come on from Deadwood, South Dakota. And a week after that will be, I can't pronounce his name, Paul Rademacher, I think. I'm going to have to find out the right pronunciation. Executive Director of the Monroe Institute and author of a book called Spiritualist Guide to the Universe. Spiritual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe. Anyways, I'm partway through the book, but it's a really cool book. Before I forget, I just wanted to throw them two things out there. So, Josh, what have you been up to all week besides making me sick?
Oh, the same old usual stuff, the usual job searching and trying to get out there. But anyways, had a fun week. I had the few things going on down at the Houghton Mansion, which was pretty fun. And last night I gave a nice tour, a group of 13, 14 people, and did a nice haunted tour. If anyone listens ever interested and they want to travel up to Massachusetts into the northwest corner of Massachusetts, you can always drop me an email and we'll see if the building's available. Those are always fun. One thing that happened, we had a 7-year-old girl that attended the tour and was absolutely amazed and loved ghost hunting and really wanted to kind of get into it. And for a 7-year-old, had absolutely no fear whatsoever to jump into a haunted room or confront a ghost or anything along those lines. And it comes up, and it kind of brought to my mind a question that has actually been asked to me a few times within the past few weeks, involving in a couple cases of mine and a few other, random moments where people have kind of asked me, and it kind of made me want to shift gears a little bit here tonight. I have a whole page of notes here for the cryptozoology stuff, which I would like to probably cover in the 8 o'clock hour there and our second half. But something I kind of get back to the ghost stuff for a little while in the first half or first hour of the show and try and squeeze it on the first hour of the show here is, ghost hunting in children, psychicism in children, and stuff along those lines. I encourage, as I kind of get into this, I kind of want to encourage any psychics or ghost hunters who are listening to call in with any of their own theories or thoughts on the subject. Call in at 646-716-5896 and offer up your opinion on it. I kind of just sprung this on Al at the last minute, but why not? It should be a good topic.
That's the way I like it. My first thought is I've heard on a whole bunch of shows that all kids can see ghosts. That's where imaginary friends come from, and then they grow out of it. So could this 7-year-old see ghosts?
I don't think she could see ghosts. Georgia Peach here, who has just arrived, kind of wants to know what's going on. For those of you who are listening, feel free to also jump in the chat room. We're in and out of that, talking with you just as much as we are probably over the air. We're going to be talking about ghost hunting in children and kind of psychicism in children here for the first hour. And who knows, maybe if the topic streams long enough, you can take in. I mean, I have a whole lot of notes that on the cryptozoology stuff that I wanted to get to also. We could save it for another day. Or, do it in our second hour here. But for whatever reason, this kind of sprung on me over the last week and especially last night. And I said, this is a topic I kind of want to get out and get into tonight for some reason. The path led me down that way, or something led me down that path, I should say.
I know how that is, so go for it.
Yeah, like I said, it was cool last night. I had this little girl, 7 years old, was absolutely phenomenally loved ghost hunting. But, and like you had just said, and it actually happened with a recent case of mine that I'm starting to investigate, and hopefully within the next couple of weeks I'm going to have a team together. And in this case is out here in Massachusetts, and basically the client came to me saying that she believes that her deceased husband, who was a victim of a homicide 3 years ago, is now haunting their house or is troubling them, and it really isn't just moving on and letting them move on with their lives. And it all started right off the back with just after the wake and the funeral that this woman's, at the time, 3-year-old daughter would wake up in the middle of the night saying how her father, daddy, was visiting her. And 3 years later now, the activity is still just as strong, and she still to this day is seeing her father waking her up at night, and it's now getting to the point where it's kind of scaring her. And one of the first questions that was asked of me by this client when she approached me about the investigation and possibly trying to help them or help her deceased husband move along was, is it possible that children have the ability to see spirits more easily than adults? And this is a question that has really been thrown around a lot in the paranormal and the ghost hunting field. No one really recommends that you take children with you on a ghost hunt. We'll kind of get into that later as to why. But I think it's very possible that they have the ability to see more, feel more, and sense more in the world around them than maybe most adults. I don't know really what your feeling on the subject is, Al.
I'm not really sure yet. I hear all these people say that that's what a lot of the imaginary friends are, is kids actually seeing spirits, but I'm still not quite sure if I'm ready to believe that or not. So, I don't know where I stand on that, to tell you the truth.
it's a tough one, and you're absolutely right. Is, at what point do you draw the line, I guess, from what's an imaginary friend and what is a possible spirit? And then if you do feel that maybe this is something more than an imaginary friend, what course of action do you take to either get this to stop being around your child, or maybe get the child to understand what is going on? And I think a lot of it has to do with the actual household and, how the family itself views the afterlife spirituality, its psychicism, as to where you kind of go from there.
I know my mother-in-law's house, ever since I met them in 1980, I mean, they've always said that there's a little boy spirit in their house. And she's had grandchildren in the living room, and she hears them playing with them. And she's never seen him, I don't think, but he moves stuff around and plays with the kids and things like that, and she's never bothered her. In fact, she likes him being there. But I don't know, you know, like you said, it depends on the family. We got a caller here, and I know she's going to give us her comments here, because she's already set them in the chat room. Marie, you there?
Hi. How you guys doing?
All right.
Good. How are you, Marie?
Good.
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you.
All right. You
said nice,
you'd
peaceful
never let
Sunday.
You said you'd never let your kids participate. Why?
I have three daughters who thoroughly enjoy ghost hunting and, of course, watching Ghost Hunters, Paranormal State, Haunting Evidence, all of that jazz, you know, on TV. And they love the idea of going ghost hunting. But I don't think that emotionally they're mature enough to handle it, or psychologically, emotionally, or any of the above. They're not able to handle it yet, because I don't know if they can distinguish between reality, what's real and what's not real.
My first thought of that is, how you said they can't handle it psychologically. How much of that is a true psychological danger, or how much is it just us adults projecting our fears onto the kids? Like Josh said, this kid the other night had no fear. She wasn't afraid of any of this stuff, didn't bother her in the least. And so how much of that is us projecting our own fears onto the kids? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true, but, I mean, how often do you know that, I mean, did you talk to the parents? Does this little girl wake up with nightmares? Does she see things in her room at night? Does she have little things under her bed and in her closet? You really don't know until you're at home at night and with the kids, and that's when they're waking up at 3 in the morning coming to your bed. Mommy!
And a lot of that, I think, is to do with the parents, too. It's almost like... I don't know what other things in life, but if you don't make a big deal out of them, they won't either. So if the child doesn't grow up with you being scared of every little thing and telling, you know, scary movies and all this stuff and telling them that they're supposed to be scared, they wouldn't know they're supposed to be scared when they watch them.
Right, and my kids aren't, because I've always brought them up to believe. I've always believed in ghosts, and I've always believed in the other side and the paranormal. And we really don't do the scary movies. I myself don't enjoy them, but I haven't stopped them from watching them. But in most groups, to investigate and bring children, it's a liability issue as far as the location. If they got hurt or whatever, the owner or the person who owns the house, the business can get in big trouble for letting a child come in there under the age of 18 or 21,
right.
Whatever it is.
And I have to agree with you, and I just want to kind of clarify what I did do. This wasn't an investigation that we were conducting by any means with this child present. This was just a tour. I'm just like any other haunted tour you would take of Gettysburg or any other haunted location offers us tours. We weren't investigating or trying to stir anything up. I don't want everybody thinking I'm out here letting seven-year-olds investigate with my group. That doesn't happen and never will, at least I don't think it ever will. I have a 6-year-old going on 7 and 11-year-old daughters. Just because I do so much with a haunted building and a haunted location, they do spend a lot of time there. I can tell you the 11-year-old is petrified of it and doesn't like to kind of walk around in the darker corners of the building. And my 6-year-old, I can't say it's fearless, but at the same time, will go into the basement or into this room when she knows it's haunted and kind of follow me around when I'm setting things up for certain events or doing a tour. She'll take the tour with me and stuff like that. So I don't want everybody out here suddenly thinking I had a 7-year-old last night tagging around with me on an investigation. This was just a haunted tour. I didn't really get in with a family whether or not she, you know, had nightmares or visitors or anything like that. It was actually just a matter of we were having a tour. They were on vacation from Florida up here in Massachusetts and stopped by the building and wanted a tour, and they jumped in on another tour that I had going on already. I think she was really fascinated with it. We were doing it at the Houghton Mansion, and she saw our episode on Ghost Adventures and wanted to see the place that was on TV, and we let her come on in. I gave her a K2 meter to hold while she was walking around to make her kind of feel a little more special than everybody else in the group, and she had a lot of fun, but we weren't investigating. I think there's a big difference between doing a walking tour than actually investigating. When you're investigating, you're trying to draw things out, pull things out, and go along those lines.
What is your location? I'll get off of here. I know you guys are talking. What is your location you're at? You said it's on Ghost Adventures? I came in
right,
kind of after you started this show, so I missed the beginning.
Well, I'm located up in North Adams, Massachusetts. If you're a fan or watched Ghost Adventures at all, the fourth episode of season one was the Houghton Mansion, and I am kind of the paranormal caretaker for the building. I run all the paranormal events, sleepovers, tours, and conferences that are held there that are related to the paranormal. And if you were familiar with the show or if you've seen it when they do their walkthrough tour of the building, I was the one on camera for that and locked them in and locked them in at night and unlocked them out in the morning.
Very cool. I'll have to look it up on YouTube. Well, thanks for letting me call into the show, you guys. I'll hang around and listen to see what else other people say. But thanks.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
Absolutely.
For calling in.
And we encourage anybody else, and we encourage anyone else who has an opinion, feel free to call in. I'm always up for a good debate on any subject, whether even if I agree with it, I will pretend to disagree just for the purpose of debate sometimes. But I do agree with her on a lot of things. I do agree with Maria on pretty much everything she said, though. And if anybody else who wants to call in, the number is 646-716-5896. Where she was going with that, and I'm going to kind of add a piece to what she said, where a child really isn't psychologically, mentally, or physically prepared to deal with something that might occur or happen during the course of an investigation. I think also at the same time, they're not psychically, physically, or mentally prepared to defend themselves against something that may happen. How many times, for anybody who's familiar with the show, A Haunting on Discovery Channel, A Haunting in Connecticut, A Haunting, they're usually labeled Haunting in Connecticut, A Haunting in Vermont, A Haunting at different locations. And you see, these hauntings that they usually document in this are usually cases of very severe hauntings, not your regular Casper the Friendly Ghost type of stuff. And a lot of times with these, you see that they start and they evolve around children. And I think it's because their defense and their ability and vulnerability is a lot lower than adults. And you see these spirits, especially the ones that aren't so friendly, and even demonic possessions are more apt to attach to a small child. So even if you are investigating, say, just a house that, you feel a previous owner from three generations ago may be haunting, there's nothing to say that maybe now you could draw something else in that's disguising itself as the friendly ghost. And the last thing you want is to open your child up to a poltergeist or demonic type of thing, because their psychic ability, their vulnerability is a lot less to defend off that type of attack.
I can't I wouldn't see sending, you know, kids out by themselves. I would think if you were investigating as a team, you'd have to have an adult with a child. But I'm going to play devil's advocate here, even though I'm not even sure I believe in demons, but that's another discussion. I'm still saying a lot of it has to do with the conditioning, like you said, of the home life or the conditioning from the parents. I mean, if a kid was brought up and was told that ghosts are no big deal, they're the same as living human beings, you just can't see their bodies anymore, and there was absolutely nothing to be afraid of, then I think the child would be in a lot better position than the ones whose parents are scared of every little noise in the dark and cower under the pillows during scary movies and all that stuff. And I don't know, maybe it's just because I haven't personally been involved, but I haven't heard of very many cases where someone was actually physically harmed. I don't know. Some of these guys I see on TV come up with these scratches every now and then, and that's, unless I saw them happen right in front of my eyes, I'm going to be skeptical on how those happen. So I don't know.
And that's a logical reaction, I think, with anybody. I feel the same way. I'm always one that wants to personally see or experience myself. I've been touched, you know, jabbed a few times from a spirit. I've never had physical marks. This case that I just referred to a little while ago about the, you know, the child seeing her deceased father. It's, you know, with this case now, you know, the mother's moved on with another relationship, and they, you know, are actually feel like sometimes there's somebody trying to get between them in bed. The new boyfriend is sometimes has the sensation of being choked or his legs being pushed or tripped. Yeah, no physical signs. And I think, you know, when I first talked to her, and I said, that's almost kind of a relief. A lot of times, I know you're not a big believer in demonic possession or anything along those lines, but I think normally when you're dealing with just human spirits, some sort of just intelligent haunting that may be more powerful than others, you know, you have the physical sensation of being touched, opposed to the actual physical, you know, manipulation of the body, you know, actually causing burn marks, scratches, handprints, and stuff like that. But to kind of go back a little bit on what you said and continue more on kind of what I was just saying about how the family life and the upbringing of the kid and the children can help kind of mold their mind into what they will be like in the future and their ability to accept, react, and see spirits. You gotta, if you look at most people now, more people are more open-minded, and there's a lot more people who are coming to terms and accepting the fact that there may be an afterlife, and that in some way or manner is now interacting with our living lives. 40, 50 years ago, when society was much more religious-based and more people went to church, and you were told there that there was no such thing as spirits. There is an afterlife, but it only includes heaven and hell, and there's no in-between. That was instilled more into the children. Now, as a child, you know, say you are seeing a spirit, or you are having a psychic skills, or you're able to do things that, you know, other children can't. The common practice was, you know, for the parents to say you're just imagining things, you're seeing things. It's not real. It's not real. It's make believe. It's not real. Just ignore it. years and years of saying that, it has, you know, molded their mind to saying, what I feel is not real, I ignore it. And eventually that ignoring it, just, and it goes away. You raise the same child in a household where you almost want to say they nurture the gift, if they do have a gift of being a psychic and the gift of seeing spirit, then if that parent says, well, maybe what you're seeing is spirit, and they, and this would obviously, it would help if the parent themselves has some sort of the same abilities, and that a lot of times people are thought that, you know, psychicism and the ability to see spirit does run in the family. If it's nurtured and said, okay, you know, you may be seeing spirits, and they might just be doing this, they might just be trying to tell you a message, don't be scared of them, but don't, you know, let them get too close to you, just listen to their message, and that's that. It's not repressed in their brain anymore that it's imaginary, it's make-believe, and just ignore it, and then these are the people that grow up to be people who claim to be psychic and have psychic abilities and work with them, opposed to the ones that had it repressed over years and years. I think a good way to kind of relay it and put it in another sense is if you have a child and from the day they were born, you show them a card, and that card is, for all our practical purpose, the color red. But you tell them every time you show them that red card that it's blue. And you say, this card is blue, this card is blue. And every time they say, hey, but it's red, no, it's blue. By the time they get old enough, they're going to be conditioned to think red is blue. And that other, you know, it's a conditioning of the mind and, you know, the reactions.
Yep, same thing. Ghosts are bad. Ghosts are good. It all depends on how they're brought up. And if they're brought up not to be afraid of those types of things, then I think there shouldn't even be a psychological question.
Right. But there are people out there who don't believe in the afterlife, and
yep.
You know, when the child has maybe an imaginary friend, and I'm not saying there's not. I would most likely probably think that most people or most children probably do have just imaginary friends. But there may be that couple who are, you know, they are seeing an occasional spirit, and it's just getting lumped in with that imaginary friend thing, and then just getting kind of, and then for the lack of a better word, I don't want to, you know, be out of that. You know, it's not real, it's not real, it's not real. And then as you grow up and you mature, it's you're just going to accept the fact that what you saw wasn't real, and then you just won't see it anymore.
Well, if you had an imaginary friend as a kid, and nobody told you that they couldn't see it, you wouldn't know the difference. So, once again, it's all based on what everyone else is telling you. How do you know the people that can't see it aren't the ones that are screwed up?
It's the definition
of normal, you know?
Yeah, who knows? And that's what we deal with the paranormal, I guess. It's it's above and beyond, and we don't really know anyways.
Yeah, so are we normal and psychics are abnormal, or did once upon a time everybody had the psychic ability, and now the rest of us have just screwed up and lost it, so now the psychics are the only normal ones left, you know? So what's normal, you know?
I don't know. I've come to the fact in this world that I have no idea what's actually normal.
All I know is my father died when I was 7, and I would have loved for him to come see me every night when I was in bed. I would have paid for that.
Yeah. And I'm sure a lot of people who are grieving probably would. But I don't know. You kind of have to go back at the same point know, I don't know. I think it might be hard for them to understand. The human mind is a complicated thing, and I'm going to just relate this to some of my own personal experiences. You know, I was investigating for 7 years until I had the first, I would have to say, physical touch by a spirit. And I wasn't scared. I didn't get scared. I didn't run. I didn't, you know, scream. But it impacted me very differently than the first time I captured an EVP or the first time, you know, I got a picture of a spirit. My heart raced for hours afterwards, and I just remember saying to myself, wow. When you repeat it, wow, this is really weird. This was different. I wasn't expecting it. And it was, you know, I can imagine me at 30 years old having that experience, saying it was very profound. And if I'm in a house with a child and she or he gets, you know, just a small touch on the back or, you know, a tug on their clothes from spirit, it might really do something to them, you know, profoundly. It might, you know, for me as a 30-year-old, my heart raced. I was like, wow, that was weird. It was like an energy rush. And I can't imagine what that would be like possibly for a child to experience.
Don't mind me, I'm typing at the same time here.
I know, I'm trying to read and talk at the same time.
Well, the thing is, you being as old as you were, maybe your fears and experiences were a lot more than a kid's would be because you've had all that many extra years of conditioning.
That is true, yeah, and that's true. And I suppose if we got enough people in this room and talking with us, I think we could have a debate for hours on the subject and really go back and forth like crazy on this because, you know, I say this at least once every show. It's the unknown, and we really don't know how to act and react in these situations. Just based on that, I really don't think I would be real quick to jump on sending a child into an investigation. Well, I know our caller mentioned, you know, no one under the age of 18. I guess that's a good guideline to really kind of follow. I think maybe if you have a 17-year-old who's very mature and understanding and secure with themselves and their mind, they may be okay. I guess you kind of have to pull a case by case. Where they are and how much they've matured. Would I say a 10-year-old? No, never a 10-year-old or 11 or 12-year-old.
You've got to have a cutoff point so it's not objective. And I can see from the liability standpoint as far as insurance works, but I'll tell you that I own some 10-year-olds that are a hell of a lot smarter than some 40-year-olds I know.
Absolutely, and that's very true, too. You got to have that cutoff line. Okay, 18 is the line. But I'd be willing to bet if I did a survey or a pool of anything, I'm sure I could find some 16-year-olds who were much more mentally developed and secure in themselves to be able to handle it. But, you know, for the sake of anything, you do have to have that cutoff and that limit where you just say, all right, you can't do 18. That's it. That's enough. And liability-wise, you're absolutely right. I mean, you're going into a house in the dark with wires and cameras and, you know, somebody trips and breaks their ankle or something. You know, you don't want to do that to a child either or the homeowner, you know, with insurance and liability things. Most groups and, you know, don't hold the homeowner liable. Some groups have waivers, you know, that they'll have the homeowner sign, you know, we're not liable for any damage, and you're not liable for any injury, you know, to any of our team during the course of an investigation, you know, blah, blah, legal jargon, basically, but, which kind of begs to differ, you know, in a kind of a little point that I wanted to get to that's here on my notes, you know, is take the argument, you know, can't you take a child, and what would kind of be the pros and cons to each?
I would say kids have better psychic abilities. And
absolutely, yeah.
You could use them as a little, you know, if you put a harness on them, a little fuzzy-haired EMF type detector type thing, you know, just another. You get a big bag, you can stuff them in there like another tool in your toolbox, you know, and just pull them out when you need them.
Oh, and now I could say, along the same point, that animals are also more apt to be sensitive. You know, instead of bringing your 6-year-old along, why don't you take your chihuahua with you and let him walk around?
My thought was, how come someone hasn't thought of trying to train a German Shepherd or something to detect ghosts the way they do drugs and everything else? You know.
And that's a good point, and that's very true, because most investigators or, you know, people in the field do feel that animals are more sensitive than humans. You always kind of hear, you know, how a dog will kind of perk up and, you know, look at something when you can't see it, and, you know, you might have maybe just heard a mouse going by the window, but you could train animals instead of putting a child in that situation, have your dog instead.
Yeah, I mean, they teach dogs to do all kinds of things, find bodies, find bombs, find this, find that. I don't know, maybe the problem is we're not even sure yet when we've detected a ghost and when we haven't. I mean, we're guessing that it's high EMFs and low temperatures and all this stuff, but nobody really knows for sure yet, so maybe that's why.
Yeah, it's very possible. And I guess now, you know, the last thing I really kind of wanted to pop in with this discussion, and this should probably wrap us through the last 20 minutes here of the hour, is what to watch for, you know, in your child or any children in particular when we're talking about spirits, and if they might have some sort of special ability that others don't, and really what to do with it then at that point. And again, anybody listening who has any opinion or thought on the subject, again, feel free to call in 646-716-5896. Or if you have a microphone and speakers, obviously you have speakers if you're listening, or a headset on your computer, you can press the click the talk button on Blog Talk Radio and join us through that. But, you know, if you have a child now and you think they have more than just an imaginary friend going on, or you think, you know, say you go out in the public, you're just out and about with them, and that you say, you know, oh, so-and-so's here talking to me, and it seems to be developing more than just that imaginary friend thing. Now, you know, what do you do with it, and how do you nurture, you know, either the gift that they have, you know, do you try to get rid of it? Do you not want your child to grow up psychic? Do you let them continue to grow with it with help? You know, if you're not a psychic, maybe you know somebody who is, and they can help coach them and learn how to deal with it. Anything along those lines.
Sorry about that. I was typing again. Well, did you have a question there? I didn't even hear it. I'm having trouble multitasking today.
You know, that's why I got to walk away from my computer, because if I sit here and try to read what's going across,
I'm reading what's going on in the chat room here and stuff, and it's like, all right, if I get too in deep in the conversation in the chat room, I forget to listen to you. Once again,
yeah.
Proving that any two monkeys can do a radio show. So,
yeah, modern technology is a wonderful thing. Yeah, but
yeah.
No, basically. My question or my next topic of discussion is, you know, where do we go and what do you do once you feel your child has a gift? Do you want them to continue it and nurture it? Do you want them to suppress it? Maybe bring it back at a later date? Anything along those lines?
I mean, a lot of that has to do with, as we saw, they're discussing psychic kids here in the chat room, and we saw in one episode of Psychic Kids that the mother being Catholic, you know, the psychic abilities were really 180 degrees away from her beliefs, so I think a lot of that's going to have to do with the household. Me, personally, I'd love to be able to enhance my own abilities, my kids' abilities. I mean, if you get to the point where you can see them and talk to them and stuff every day, then it's not a big deal anymore. You know, a lot of the problem now with the kids is, and adults too, is you half of what scares you is you can't see it. You don't know what it is. You don't know when it's coming or anything like that. So if you could enhance your abilities to see those things and hear those things, then I would think that's just another tool in your line of defense, you know?
Absolutely.
That's why I can't wait to get this guy on the show in a couple of weeks here from the Monroe Institute, because I think that the product that they have would be such a great tool and so useful to ghost investigation teams that I can't see where it wouldn't.
All right, is that Robbie there in the chat saying he's trying to call in with us? Is he on the NIR screen?
Yep, I just see his hand going up here, so we're going to bring him right in here. All right, is that you, Robbie?
Hey, fellas, how you doing?
Good.
Very
good.
How are you?
I'm doing good, thank you. Yeah, interesting conversations and different topics. It's amazing, you know, you brought up about, I just want to backpedal just a tad here, about the dogs or animals in general. And we were sitting around the table at breakfast time, and the producer said, what can we do that's totally different and off the scale other than walking in with the electronics and trying to capture evidence? And I can see his Great Dane over his shoulder in his truck. And he loves his dogs. I mean, he's got five Great Danes and what have you. And I said, look, let me borrow your dog. I'll turn it into a Chihuahua. I guarantee you. We're going in the Sally house. And, if PETA's listening, you know, the dog never got harmed. It was just to prove a point that the sensitivity of an animal and what you're saying or what you're picking up there psychically, they will validate. And it was remarkable throughout the film. Right now, you know, just looking back at that and how the dog went through the house with us, it was about, I'd say, midday, and he made a beeline for the front door. We opened the door, and he jumped into the truck and wouldn't come back out. You see his reactions on film exactly, you know, when we're describing what's here and what's going on. It was just amazing. If anybody out there who's tuning in, that was a right key, that was the right thing to say, because if you're going on an investigation, instead of using the recorders, the IMF meters, the K2 meters, or what have you, bring an animal, and you will find out your own basic instinct. Someone said, you know, just common sense and basic intuition. Go with your gut instinct, and then bring an animal, and, you know, see how you work out rather than the electronics. But that was a great suggestion, absolutely.
I think it kind of goes into, and you know, every human has it. It's wired into your human brain is your animal instinct. It's the feeling, you know, of the hair standing up on the back of your neck in a bad situation, you know, or getting goosebumps, or that feeling of being watched. You know, I think that is our animal instinct inside our brain that. Just to kind of even go into what we were saying, that over the years you've been conditioned to suppress it just to think that it's nothing, where in actuality it may be that same animal instinct that we have, that animal that your dogs and your cats might have, that they you know, their brain, they haven't been taught to suppress that instinct quite yet.
Right, right. You know, and they're not going to lie. They're going to be, you know, right there. It's spontaneous. So it's unacted and it's unrehearsed. It's real. And then another good point you guys touched upon were the children. And I made a mention, I was in A&E's vice president's office there in New York not too long ago. And she was talking about, that was her baby. That's the show she wrote. And Chip Coffee and what have you's on. You know, I remember sitting at home coming back from Mid-South, and Dave Schrader calls me and goes, turn on the TV, we're doing a UFO segment, and Chip Coffee's there. And I said, okay, so I'm watching this UFO segment, and every night at 10 o'clock, this white blip in the sky would come across. And so they're filming, and it'd be the same thing the next night, and the same thing the next night. And so you see old Chip, he says, he's not in the film. And I said, what happened? He goes, he runs out in the field, and they say it's a UFO, and he goes, beam me up with all your power. Beam me up with all your power. And it turned out to be a satellite.
And that's true. Satellites, my own kind of amateur. I have a big telescope, so I pretend to be an astronomer every now and then. satellites are like that. They, you know, especially when the sun is at just the right angle and they're in a geosynchronous orbit, will fly over the sky at what seems to be a very high speed. Every night at relatively the same time, especially when, like I said, if you get it, the sun at the right angle, the sun bounces back off of it just like it bounces back off the moon.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, guys.
You
just wanted to call in a couple of those points.
Yes, thank you very much. We've doubled our number of callers in one day than we've had in the entire time of the show.
Is that right? Don't win a prize.
Yeah,
you guys
you
have
get
a wonderful
to go
night.
Tell a bunch of other people.
Yes, yes. Have a good night, guys.
You too.
Thanks.
That's great. I meant to ask him before you hung up. If he wants to get in the chat room, you know who he's involved with what shows. I had a brief interaction with like a kid. They were going to pull off one of my cases to bring the kids to. They have a camp out in my area, here in the Berkshires for. Children with gifts, and they were looking for a place to shoot, and we had it all scheduled and the date and the time, and they said, okay, the producers are going to call you and tell us when to meet you there, and I said, okay, I'll be looking forward to the call, and never heard from them again, not even an email or a call. So that was my own little experience with like kids, but anyways, I lost my train of thought. I went off on my little tangent there about...
Well, as far as the dogs, you know, there's a reason why the Scooby Gang had Scooby as its leader, you know.
That's right. There you go. There's your classic world-famous case of a canine paranormal investigator. I know you brought it up, and I'll bring this in because we're a little bit changing gears here, but I also think the topic is starting to run a little dry on us. Why you couldn't train a dog, a shepherd or a hound, the same way you would train them in police work, law enforcement, you know, to sniff out drugs, bombs, or people. I think with all those situations, just having, you know, experience in law enforcement, having friends of mine who got dogs, while, you know, police dogs, and witnessed their training and how they were trained. There's always that one level of control where they actually have the physical drugs. They actually train them with, you know, actual marijuana. They get, you know, permission to carry it with them and hide it in certain places. So, you know, with paranormal investigating, I suppose, unless you could have a spirit in a bottle that you could hide somewhere and then have the dog sniff it out and then reward the dog for finding it, because that's basically how the training is. You start out with them. Here's the smell of heroin. Here's a tree. Smell of heroin. Here's a tree. Now you hide the heroin. Sniff it out. Here's a tree. It's kind of hard to get that. Here's the smell of a ghost, or here's the sensation of a ghost. Here's a tree. Now go find the ghost and go get your tree. It's unless we could have, you know, a spirit in a bottle that we could hide on them and then reward the dog for finding it. It'd kind of be a tough thing to train, just being the fact that we don't know where it is. You know, we're relying more on them to find it and just believing them that it's possibly there, opposed to, you know, with bloodhounds, you know, searching people. You know, they get rewarded when they find the person, and we know they found the person because we can see them and touch them and say, okay, here's the actual person, opposed with a ghost.
Well,
that's
impossible. It's like up in that attic where you guys were at there a few weeks back with the Frank's box and everything, and you knew there was something in that other part of the attic. See, now that's where you dig out your box of Scooby snacks and you throw a couple to the dog and send him in there.
There you go.
You can chase out whatever's in there.
It's funny, as I'm talking about it, my dog's following me around my house here as I talk about it. Like, you're talking about me, Seth. that would be a great tool. And I've heard of them. There are investigative groups out there that do use canines and cats during investigations. Maybe not so much to hunt them out, but just to watch for their reactions. You know, if you go back to even probably some of the most ancient and first, maybe use the word ghost hunters, but people who look for spirit and talk to spirit is witches, and what you always associate with a witch is, you know, their black cat. I've had conversations with some of the high priests of the witches of Salem in Massachusetts, and they have black cats, and there's particular reasons behind it. You know, they say they have the ability to sense spirit and to almost scare them off, and along those lines. You know, it's been known for ages that, you know, animals have that increased ability.
Yeah, well, I watched that Sabrina the Teenage Witch. So I mean, black cats are probably just witches that were you know, cursed or something. So
who knows? I have a black cat too, and you know, he's got a little white patch on him though. So I mean, he's not a full fledged black cat. But they kind of
yellow ones, but all my black ones always ran away for some reason.
Yeah. This one hasn't ran away, and this one just never leaves the upstairs. I have a two floor house, and this one doesn't go downstairs. He only stays upstairs. Probably because the dog is always downstairs, so he figures I'm just going to be smart, avoid the hassle, and stay upstairs. All right.
Sounds right to me. Well, you were talking about dogs. What other animals do you want to talk about?
Well, I was going to kind of eventually segue right into our cryptozoology discussion, which we wanted to bring up for our second half here. I just figured we can take the next 8 minutes of the hour here and kind of to wrap up the whole, you know, what would you do with your child once you feel they have that gift? Where would you take them, and how would you treat it?
I know what I would do, but I don't want to give it away because it's going to be the theme for our show in a couple of weeks, and I don't want
to. Yeah, we don't want to do that. I'm already looking forward to that show.
Let me just say that the person that's going to be on represents a company with some very unique products that I'm actually starting to use, and I think it's going to be kind of neat. So definitely... I would have my kids start using some of those, but I can't tell you what it is. So.
All right, that's not a problem. Because if nobody listens then, it'll be all my fault. I'll kind of just quick, you know, give my lowdown on it, and then we can switch gears and do like a lot of these other shows do and run two different topics. Like I said, I think this one's starting to hit its its end here. But, you know, and I'll think of my own experience. You know, I have two young daughters. I obviously, you know, believe in the afterlife. And they know what I do. They know that I investigate the paranormal and that I give people tours of haunted houses and go out and look for ghosts. My youngest, I don't want this to kind of be misinterpreted as the wrong way, because I don't really think she has any ability. But we use the Houghton Mansion is where I pretty much go to and do most of my investigations. And when there's not a babysitter, they go with me for the tours and whatnot, and they hear the story. They hear about, you know, this ghost might be here, this ghost might be here. And one of the key stories or possible spirits in the Houghton Mansion is that of a younger girl in the basement of the mansion. And she's heard the story so many times now that she actually is now getting, whenever we go there, she tells everybody how there's a little girl that's my friend in the basement. I kind of leave it at that. She doesn't ever say how she talks to her or communicates with the little girl, but being a typical six-year-old, she goes, oh, it's another little girl, she can be my friend. If it was more than that, though, if she started to come to me and say, I was with you, Dad, in the basement, and, you know, that little girl that's my friend talked to me, or she said something to me, at that point, then I would start to maybe take some more action. I myself, claiming to have the psychic ability of a rock, and I knowing her mother never really had any psychic ability or background, wouldn't be the one to help her nurture it. I wouldn't shun it away from her or say that, you know, what you did was wrong or what you heard was your imagination. I wouldn't go that route. I would probably, at that point, you know, tell her that, okay, you know, what you are feeling and what you are hearing is okay. It's not scary. If you are scared of it or something that does scare you, let somebody else know. But I would most likely go somewhere within a network of people that I know who are the trusted psychics that I know. And there are a handful of people with psychic ability that I trust and use during the course of my investigations when one is needed. And I would most likely go to them and say, okay, well, now what do I do? Or, you know, is there something I can do to make this more comfortable for her or to understand what's going on or how it's happening along those lines?
If she came to you and said that her friend was talking to you, my first thought is, who's the one that has the problem with it, you or her?
And that's true.
She just comes to you nonchalantly and says, oh, yeah, now I'm talking to her and I see her and all this stuff. It's like most of the time it's going to be the parent that's more freaked out than the kid is.
And I think I would have some reservations about it. I do know that some people with psychic ability sometimes have a hard time fitting in with normal society. And I'm not trying to say in a bad way. It's sometimes they just have a hard time dealing with it. So I think I would have my reservations about it, and I would be concerned. But I think as long as, you know, you approached it properly and moved along with it the right way, I think it would all work out as long as it's nurtured the right way. I think that's the biggest thing I kind of wanted to hit with this whole topic for our first hour here.
Right. I see Mr. Robbie's leaving us here. So.
Thanks for listening, Rob, and I hope you listen next week.
He's going to miss all the Bigfoot stuff coming up next here.
I got a few little creatures I wanted to talk about. And let me switch pages now. Now I got to change my web browser and go to part of the research I all did today. I went to a few different web pages, and, you know, like any show, I always kind of research it up before. Basically, now
I was down all day yesterday, so I didn't get to do much research. I went to Hartford, Connecticut, and back. So,
well, I was lucky amongst a lot of people, and for whatever reason, a good chunk of the Berkshires had an incredible power surge. And I got a few friends who actually lost some electronic equipment through the power surge during some bad rains and a little bit of a thunderstorm. And I'm thankful that things like my PlayStation and laptop and the more expensive pieces of electronics I have hooked up to the wall are all still in one piece and not smoking. And if that were to happen, I think I'd be in total trouble if my laptop went down on me. I could live without the PlayStation, but if I lost my laptop, I'd be in big trouble.
Well, I was just going to say, I noticed you mentioned the PlayStation first.
Oh, that works like just as much as my computer, too. So who knows? I use them both about the same, because that's nothing but a big computer anyways. So,
yeah, I do, too, because I got movies and stuff on my computer here in the living room, and then I've got the PlayStation 3 in the bedroom. So I can go in there at night and just lay in bed and pull up any of the files that I've got out here on the computer and just watch movies all night long, you know.
Exactly, because I don't have cable or satellite, so I just everything I watch I stream over the internet or download and pull back up through the media server. But anyways,
we're
going to turn this into an electronics show now.
Hey, why not? What the heck?
Electronics and ghosts do go. Funny story, just for that tour last
Ghost in the Machine?
Ghost in the Machine. Ghost. Favorite quote of mine, electronics take batteries, and a favorite quote of mine in ghost hunting that I heard, and I wish I remember who said it, but, you know, ghosts eat batteries, and that is so true, and it actually happened. You know, it's on that tour I was with last night, the people came, and they went in, and they go to do their tour, and her batteries died in her camera. I says, you know, Josh, would you happen to have any extra batteries? And I keep my run case or whatever. You know, it's just a briefcase with my general. If I were to have to, like, an emergency investigation or have to go somewhere real quick to look for ghosts, everything I would absolutely have to need to conduct an investigation is in that box. And of course, like any ghost hunter, includes some batteries. I go, here you go. Fresh right out of the box, and they were dead in like 20 minutes. So that's ghosts and electronics for you.
Now, a special kit for emergency ghost hunting. Do you have like an ambulance with a guy on top and a bunch of flashing lights too, or what?
Yeah, I have my own little version of Ecto-1, you know. That's the best way I could describe it. You know, I have one box, you know, whenever I go to do a tour. You know, I have a couple crates that hold all my video equipment, VCRs, monitors, stuff like that. But if I'm just want to pick up and go and investigate somewhere at the last minute, I can always pick up this box, and it has a K2 in it, a digital EMF, a voice recorder, temperature sensors, dowsing rods, dowsing pendulums, a bag of flour, pencils, pens, batteries, I don't remember what else is in there, an infrared illuminator, you know, and a very small battery-powered wireless night vision camera. Just quick, it's like a go box. You know, if I want to get up and go and investigate, and I don't want to pack up or grab all my crates with all my bigger cameras and monitors in it, I can always just grab this one box, and I could do an investigation with that one box. So if there was such a thing as an emergency ghost hunt, I could grab that and go.
Okay. I don't know. I'm just trying to consider what an emergency ghost hunt would look like, but that's okay.
I know. But if I ever get one, I'll let you know. You can come along and you can find out. I've never had one. But if there ever is, I'll be prepared. All I got to do is, you know, make a copy of Ecto-1 from Ghostbusters and get a cool little pole to lie down with a buzzer to go off, and it happens, and I'll be all set to go.
Yeah, really. You got to rent, like, some old firehouse or something.
There you go. All right. Oh, no, I lost my webpage. I'm trying to track these thunderstorms that are coming at the same time, too. All right, cryptozoology. basically, we all know what zoology is, and that's just the study of animals. Crypto, or cryptids, is the study of hidden animals. Cryptid means hidden. Zoology is literally just study of animals. So, hidden animals, cryptozoology. This really falls in the paranormal realm, basically, because these aren't animals that we don't see. The majority of people don't see. They're hidden. They're mythical. Some people believe in them. Some people don't believe in them. Just like us. Just like ghosts and spirits. Some people believe in ghosts and spirits. Some people see them and some people don't. Well, some people believe in Bigfoot. Some people don't. Some see them and some don't. So cryptozoology falls in that realm of the paranormal. And it's gaining popularity now, just like all other paranormal fields. That you can turn on cable now, and you can see a TV show on every network that's, you know, Ghost Hunter started it, but now you have every cable network has its version. They have the kids' versions on Cartoon Network. They got Ghost Adventures on Travel Channel. You know, it's all over the place. And now you're starting to see UFO hunters, and now... If I was actually just watching it this afternoon, and it was weird, I'm sitting here taking notes about finding hidden animals and cryptozoology, and I was at my girlfriend's house, and I look, and I throw it on the TV, and it's a show called Monster Quest, and their whole purpose is finding hidden animals in cryptozoology. So, you know, this is hitting mainstream, just like your paranormal investigating ghost hunting is. This is now getting just as much popularity, and who knows, maybe 5 years from now, just like 5 years ago, there was just ghost hunters. Maybe every network's going to have their monster hunters and their UFO hunters and everything else, you know, in the realm of the paranormal, as we have embraced as our realm here on Haunted America. But I think when we talk about cryptozoology, and, you know, what it is, the main animal, the one thing that is, if you were to mention it, everybody would know of is Bigfoot. Now, there are other cryptids out there that are just as popular within its field, but other people on the street might not be familiar with. The Thunderbird, the Chupacabra. Loch Ness, everybody's heard of, and everybody might not know about Champ and Lake Champlain. There's a large lake in Canada that has its own creature. There's actually an entire study of different cats up your way in Vermont. The catamount actually kind of falls into cryptozoology. The catamount itself is said to be extinct, but now there are large mountainous cats being seen in Vermont that were always thought to be extinct. So now this is starting to fall into the realm of cryptozoology. There's the lynx or the black cat. I was watching today on this Monster Quest. It's a large black tiger-like animal that roams the plains of Oklahoma. These stories are all over the place. And even when you go to the Wikipedia entry on cryptozoology, right in the top half of it, it really includes such as phantom cats, large cat creatures that aren't documented as either mountain lions, tigers, cougars, bears, oh my.
Do alligators in the sewers fall into that category?
See, that's where it gets kind of weird. That's kind of where I want to be sure even where if the catamount would fall into it. The catamount is a known documented animal and has just gone extinct, but it's getting seen in. So, this not being my field, my field personally being spirits and ghosts, I would imagine a cryptozoology specialist who is harder to go come by than I would imagine, because I've tried to get a couple to be on the show and with not the greatest luck. There's a few that are out there, but they're the more popular ones, and they are offered a book for appearances on radio shows. So I would imagine if it continues to grow, then there might be some more people out there who could explain it a little bit easier. I mean, crypto, and just like any other field, it has its criticism and its defense. You know, it's been criticized basically on its, for the sake of argument, when we talk about it, you know, when we talk about it in general, I'm going to use the term Bigfoot, because that's, you know, Bigfoot is probably the most popular case of cryptozoology, that or Loch Ness. I just had a huge crash for my upstairs, but anyways, totally killed my train of thought.
You know how I am over here all the time, so how's that multitasking stuff work for you?
Oh, are you still there?
Yeah?
No, something just crashed up in my upstairs, so maybe I gotta go. So that just totally ruined my train of thought.
Bring something home with you last night, did you?
I don't know, maybe.
I mean, besides what you usually bring home with you, because I see your messages.
Where was I now? basically, the criticisms of it usually fall behind on the along the lines of the same criticisms we face in the paranormal realm. The people doing the investigations and the people behind the said sightings don't follow the typical scientific method, to devote to it and see, what they're finding is truly real or not. Generally, the belief is just based upon eyewitness sightings and not scientific backing or true evidence. And then there's always the true defenders of it that, say, these are truly reliable people with their statements, these pictures that people are capturing of Bigfoot are true pictures of Bigfoot and not pictures of a man in a suit and stuff along those lines. So there's a very big line in between the two of them, as to what's real and what isn't. And it gets the same cryptozoology and the study of it gets the same kind of stuff we do, that it has its share of fakes and people pretending to do this type of stuff. And it's really tough to say, what is the true findings and what was just the, the guy down the street wearing a big mask and an outfit to try and scare you.
I'm here. I'm reading and listening at the same time here. Georgia Peach was just talking about the Georgia Bigfoot hoax, and I started watching that with a keen eye. I said, this would be really cool, but no, this is too good to be true. And, of course, it turned out to be.
And they, and that's the sad part. And I think, unlike any other field, we have our share of fake pictures that people have tried to pass off as real, in the ghost hunting world. But I think no other paranormal field, and, the paranormal has its, its fields, the ghost hunters, the UFO hunters, the cryptozoologists, the psychic people, every field really, it's its own subset of paranormal investigating. I think no other one has been more torn apart and more insulted and more put in the limelight than, the cryptozoology, especially when it comes to the line of Bigfoot, because of the fact that there have been so many public sightings and public hoaxes and fakes that have really, if there were somebody really trying to out there and document it and study it, that it would set the field back by, years. All this research I've done is now gone because somebody was messing with me and hoaxing with me.
I don't know. I have a hard time believing something that that's that big, as big as a Bigfoot, you know, 8 foot, 9 foot, whatever the heck it is. If you're that size, you've got to eat a lot.
Yep.
And it don't seem to me you're going to hide up in the mountains as much as you do. I mean, you got bears that come in the neighborhoods and stuff all the time looking for food, you know, and it's like I have a hard time believing something that big can just stay up there where nobody ever sees it and not starve to death. So, yeah, gentleman's just asking about the Patterson film, if you think it's genuine. I'm not sure. I mean, I've seen both sides. I've seen this guy come out who swears up and down, yes, he was in a suit. But then I've also seen where other people have said the muscle structure and the way it walks and everything is not human and you can't duplicate it. So I don't know what's what.
Oh, it's tough. And I agree with your thought on that, you know, something this big and smelly. Anybody, whoever is a witness to Bigfoot, always references to how bad it smells. And this will kind of go into one point I wanted to make about Bigfoot, is this isn't a regional thing. Bigfoot is known worldwide, but just under different names. If you go down south, I'm sure Georgia Peach there in the chat room has heard about the Florida skunk ape. Skunk ape is probably because it smells. But it is more or less a Bigfoot. It's a large ape-like creature, stands very tall. This one said to have a little bit less fur or a lighter colored fur. And its stench, its smell, is supposed to be worse than anything else. The Pacific Northwest.
Well, of course, it makes sense. If it's way down in Florida where it's warmer all the time, it's not going to need such a big coat or as much fur as you would if you were up north.
Absolutely. I think in the Americas, the biggest hotbed or biggest area known for Bigfoot sightings is the Pacific Northwest. And if you imagine that area, that's just vast forests, you know, miles of forests. You know,
yeah,
an animal could live in
there for 3 years.
You know, an animal could live in there and never be seen. It's like the rainforest. There's animals in there and creatures that have never been seen and documented. There's insects that are still being found and documented in the rainforest. Some of these Pacific Northwest forests are probably just as big as these rainforests. Now,
they could probably blend in with some of the residents of Seattle and nobody know the difference either. So
that's true. That could be very well true, too. If anyone from Seattle is listening, I'm sorry.
I couldn't resist. I lived in Tacoma for 3 years, so I know. But come on, an animal this big has got to take a dump somewhere. I mean, judging by the size of the animal, it ain't going to be rabbit nuggets. Now, come on.
You're absolutely right. You said, you know, they got to come out for food sometime. You know, from what I hear and from what I've looked up is they say, unlike a bear is a carnivorous creature and doesn't eat just on plants. A bear, you know, they eat berries and fish. When that's not available, yeah, they're going to come in to civilization and scavenger for food and trash barrels and campsites and whatnot.
I have a hard time believing that, too. I mean, just looking at human beings, have you ever seen a fat vegetarian?
No, but now you said human beings. Now, this is an ape-like creature. Apes are much smarter than bears. Unless, you know, we're talking about, you know, a very smart circus-trained bear, but, you know, it's an ape-like creature. Obviously with a big head and a probably more developed brain, it probably knows better to stay away from civilization, open paths and open roads, and maybe only crosses them in the circumstances where they have to.
That could be, but I just have a hard time believing something that size doesn't live on protein. It just seems to me if all you're eating is leaves, that I can't see how they grow that big. You know, over time they get smaller, I would think.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think the biggest thing for me to lend credibility to it is it's not a regional thing. You know, we talked about cryptozoology a little bit last week with our myths, you know, with, you know, the Jersey Devil or the Mothman, another one that's specific really to America is the Thunderbird. Bigfoot is known worldwide and has many different names, you know, from the Skunk Ape of Florida to Sasquatch. Let me pull up the page here. I had a whole list of them. You know, he's been spotted everywhere. You know, the Abominable Snowman of the Himalayas. That
Ohio Grassman.
Yeah, I mean, so the Abominable Snowman, that's a Bigfoot. Just like the Florida Skunk Ape might have less fur because he's in a warmer climate. You know, the one that lives in the Himalayas is going to have white fur, you know, to better mask itself in the snow. Here we have just similar ones here in North America. You know, the Lake Worth Monster of Lake Worth, Texas. The Momo the Monster in Missouri. Bold Yellowtop of Ontario. Skunk Ape of Florida. Wild Man of the Nevada in Texas. Around the world, you got Chuchana of Siberia. Hibagno of Japan. These giant ape-like creatures are seen worldwide, and not just in a specific area. You know, Yeti of Tibet, Yowie of Australia. Now, these things are everywhere.
That's another thing. If they're everywhere, then how come nobody can find anything? You know, it just doesn't make any sense to me that you, in this day and age, with the equipment technology we've got, I don't care how big of a forest you've got, if you flew over it with some of the infrared equipment that, like, firemen use to find people in buildings and all that stuff, and the government uses, you ought to be able to pick up an 8-foot-tall heat signature in the middle of a forest, you know.
Well, I guess
in
we're
this day
think
and
about
age, even in this day and age, with satellites where they can zoom in from space and read a license plate off a car in New York City, they can't scan a whole big forest.
Well, one, you got to think about
in there.
You got to think about who's looking and who's going to pay for it to look. An infrared camera like the firemen use, a cheap domestic model, will run you $3,000 to $4,000. The high-end FLIR forward-looking infrared type of stuff you see, you know, on police helicopters during chases, they're very accurate, and they will pick up animals in the woods. But if a small handheld forward-looking infrared runs you $6,000 to $7,000, can you imagine the cost of one to mount on a helicopter, let alone the price of the helicopter and the pilot to fly you around? I'm sure NASA's top priority isn't to do that.
Let's talk. Well, I'm not thinking government. I'm thinking private individuals. Let's talk return on investment. Sure, they're going to spend $25,000 on this thing and mount it and go fly over something. But if they're the first ones to find something, how much money are they going to make afterwards?
That's true. That's very true. But I think, and I've seen it, and I've had the actual experience with it, you can still hide underneath a tree. In a dense enough forest, that forward-looking infrared isn't going to get you anything except for the stuff maybe hiding in the tree. Under a dense canopy of a forest, it's not penetrating through. It's not going to really see what's on the ground very clearly. Or if you do see it, it's going to appear small because you're just getting what's through the leaves. It might appear like a rabbit or something small because you're not getting the whole heat signature out of it.
Well, then you got to go in the Midwest in the wintertime when all the leaves are off the trees.
You got an answer for everything, don't you?
I'm just using common sense here. If, I mean, if these people really want to find this thing and prove that it's there, then there's got to be someone out there, a millionaire, that believes in it enough to kick up the bucks to get the equipment to go do it.
I had a great experience once. Actually, I can say I'm not a complete novice at Bigfoot hunting. I'm a novice, but not a complete novice. I did go on one excursion out into the woods with a Bigfoot hunter once, and I must say it was interesting. It was different. I can't imagine myself ever doing it. But they, you know, I was almost lost, where I kind of had the same feeling listening to this guy talk that I can see some people have when I talk about ghosts, and I can kind of get over their head talking about EMF and EVP and spirit energy, and some people are, what is he talking about? You know, is he going to pull out his photon pack next? You know, this guy started talking about, you know, this tree does this, or see the way that's bent, or, you know, looking for certain clues in different parts of the forest. But I can say he had a passion like any other too, to hunt this. He was, I wish I remember his name. I could probably pull it up on the internet. But here he was called Masquatch, the Massachusetts Sasquatch like society. And I tell you, this guy was a self-admitted, he was a two-pack-a-day smoker. But when he thought he saw something in the woods, he didn't mind the trail. He didn't mind the fact that there was no trail. He just trucked right down through the woods at faster than I could move, weaving in and out of trees to try and get down to whatever he thought he saw, you know, to get to these places. And basically, we were out there with a friend who was writing a book about different weird things in Massachusetts. And part of that is we were out in October Mountain State Forest and down in South County, South Berkshires. And you know, they had a couple Bigfoot sightings out in that neck of the woods, and we trucked all over the place. And they have some weird things, too, just like we have weird meters. Their big thing now, I guess what they're doing with Bigfoot hunting is to actually try and duplicate their screams. Like, you know, Bigfoot has a really weird scream, you know, it's either yelling for a mate or in distress or for whatever purpose. And they get these big, giant, you know, speakers mounted on their car, and they play these god-awful screams over it, try and get a response back. You know, is that any more silly than me standing in a room in the dark asking questions to the air, hoping that I get an answer back over my EVP recording?
Nope. You're both equally weird.
That's right. You all got to be a little weird to look for the unknown.
I got to answer Peach here in the chat room. She asked if we wanted to go snipe hunting.
Snipe hunting?
You never been snipe hunting?
I don't even know what a snipe is.
Peach, you're going to need to call back in here and tell them what a snipe is. Yeah, that and Sidehill Wampuses we used to go hunting for as kids and stuff. Peach's father took her snipe hunting when she was six. She told me, shut up now.
Uh-oh, I don't want to know. I'm going to have to Google it now and find out. Now,
well, actually, I did look it up, and it says a snipe is any of nearly 20 winged birds, only this isn't the snipes that we know.
Uh-oh. I'll pass on this for now.
Oh, all right.
All right, well, that was Bigfoot. And anybody who wants to chime in, feel free to call or hit the click the chat button on their, or click the talk button on their main page of Log Talk there. If you know any secret weird animals that are out there, feel free to call in with them. It's always good to have some new stories. Another one that's always really fascinating. Another
646-716-5896.
Another great story. It relates to the Americas. That's kind of what I want to stick to. And we could go worldwide, you know, and talk about all the weird animals people see around the world. And for those of you listening around the world, I'm sorry I'm neglecting your animals tonight. But another one that I thought was actually fascinating, and this one here, I can almost kind of go along the lines with you, Al, and see how come nobody sees this all the time, is a Thunderbird. Are you familiar with the Thunderbird at all, the stories behind that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge, well, I don't want to say, it's not prehistoric, really, like, but it's about the size of a pterodactyl or something, the way they're talking. I mean, bird that huge, you'd think you'd see it.
Absolutely. Now, I think when we talk about cryptozoology in general, as in Bigfoot, as we're dealing with animals of very limited numbers. I would imagine there's people who live around the forest of China and never see a panda, yet we know pandas exist, but there are very few of them, and they're dwindling away. Hell, I went to the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., where they had pandas right there in a cage, and I couldn't see it. So, you know, it was hiding off in a corner. It was, oh, there it is, and I saw a little patch of wax.
I was going to say, where'd you stop off before you went to the zoo?
You got to think, you think of even now the animals. They're, say for instance here, there are bald eagles in the Northeast. They live in the Northeast. They're known to be here. I guess they're no longer endangered, but they're, what's the stuff above endangered? It's protected. I, in my lifetime, have seen two bald eagles. So in 30 years, I've only seen two, yet they live in my area. Yet they're limited numbers. Could you adequate limited numbers of a Sasquatch to the fact that all bald eagles are known to live in my area, yet I've only seen one or two?
Yeah, actually, I saw something in the front page of the paper not too long ago that down in Hoosick Falls, not too far from here, there's a nest of bald eagles, supposedly. And I was always going to take a ride down there and find out, but I never did get there.
I think I remember the last time I saw one was in Cheshire, on Cheshire Lake out here in the Berkshires of Massachusetts. And as the thing, it was on the news. You know, it's big enough to make the news. Just as somebody saw a Bigfoot, and I suppose it makes the news. You know, somebody had this bald eagle just perched in the trees along, the lakeside here in Cheshire, Mass. And next thing you know, that day, everybody's all looking at it. It's a rare animal. Well, here's one that's not even endangered, but again, I've seen only two in my lifetime, and one was in a cage, is the great horned owl. I've only seen it twice, once in the wild and once in a cage at an animal hospital. These aren't even endangered or protected animals, yet they prowl around at night, they're quiet, they're sleuthy, and I've only seen one in 30 years of living, yet they're here and they're all around. And I live in a densely populated area, but well enough where there's enough trees and forest around me bordering houses.
I don't think I've ever seen one. I've never seen a bald eagle.
So how do you know there's not a
Bigfoot walking? I've never seen.
So how do you know there's not a Bigfoot walking around in the Green Mountains either?
Because those are a little bigger. I mean, you're talking 8 feet tall.
Well, here you go. Now, here's an animal that's so not, that's enough off the endangered list that it's actually hunted. It's not in Massachusetts, but in your state in Vermont, it's allowed to be hunted. How many times have you seen a moose in the wild?
I know the wife saw one. I don't think I've seen one.
I mean, this is an animal that is flourishing enough that it's actually allowed to be hunted and shot and killed. Yet, I've never seen one in the wild.
I mean, I don't see them, but they get hit by cars enough where about once a month you got one in the paper, so I know they got to be there. But of course, I don't leave my living room very often either. That's why I don't see half this stuff. See, I'm not an outdoorsy person. I'm a nerd. I'm a brainiac. So I just sit here. But and of course, you do all your stuff in the dark, so you wouldn't see one anyways. But,
yeah, that's true.
but the wife was parked side of the road one morning, 5 a.m., watching the sun come up, just sitting there side the road, drinking a cup of coffee, and all of a sudden a moose come walking out and walked right around the car, and she said it was so tall that the kneecaps were level with her head. And it just walked around the car a couple times and then went back in the woods, scared the crap right out of her.
No, so could you say, now that's an animal that weighs close to a ton, 2,000-pound animal, and very few people see it. Very few people see a Bigfoot that, you know, probably doesn't even weigh 2,000 pounds.
Yeah, I don't know.
There, I got you now. I stumped you.
you know, it could be that they're dying off, too, and there are just so few of them left, you know. It seems to me if they were gaining in numbers or something, you'd have more and more and more sightings as time went on. But
true, that's very true.
Be that way, you know.
I think, you know, that's right, you know, that it's something that's dying off. I started talking about, you know, the Thunderbird. You know, it basically, you're, you know, it's a large, almost, I guess, pterodactyl-sized bird. There have been a few sightings of it recently, within the past 5 years. A few back, as recently as 2007, I'm basically just kind of referring off to the Wikipedia page here. Now, there were sightings of it in 2002 and in 2007. One of the most popular and most famous sightings, though, was in the 1890s in the Arizona area. And if you look and you Google search it and do an Google image search, you can actually see the newspaper clipping of where these two cowboys actually shot at it and killed it. And then they actually posed with it and had it on the front page of the paper of them standing, you know, with their Thunderbird. A weird-like creature. They said its wings are almost bat-like and featherless, and the face resembled that of an alligator. And, you know, and through those years, right on through the late 1800s into the early 1900s, the sightings had continued. People always heard it had, like, kind of a large screech to it, kind of pterodactylish or bird of a mix between like a pterodactyl and bird of prey like screech. You know, and you know, here they have a picture. Of course, how many pictures do we have nowadays of the said Bigfoot? The naysayers here, you know, nowadays would say, you know, perspective. It's kind of the same concept I use when I debunk orbs and paranormal pictures. You know, it may seem bigger than it really is based on what's behind it. You know, it just might look like the bird has, you know, a 16-foot wingspan, when in actuality it was just a very oversized golden or bald eagle. And it just the way you looked at it, it appeared a lot bigger.
And what I'm reading here, it says, Thunderbirds are believed to attack humans by sending out evil spirits and legends. The chat room wants to know if Mothman is the same as the Thunderbird.
And that could be very well. If you look at the description of Mothman, a featherless like wings, even the Jersey Devil, or instead of an alligator type head, it was said to have a almost a horse shaped head, but you're still getting that longer, drawn out nose. A pterodactyl, if you kind of were to think of a modern creature that looked like the head of a pterodactyl, it would be a crocodile or alligator, and something along those lines. But and these are creatures that were seen and talked about in Native American practices, and I think that's where, you know, your thought of, or you're not your thought, but your story of, you know, seeing this, they think on you evil spirits. I think a lot of that is stuff from Native American practices. And the thing with that is, you know, Native American stories, they always kind of were based off some sort of truth. At some point, I'm sure one of them thought they saw a very large bird. And then, just as if we were talking about last week with the folklore and stuff like that, they, because of something they didn't understand, they had to create a story around it. And I think you know, they didn't understand the large bird, and they needed to have something to talk about and a story behind it. So they created the thought of it being, you know, a bearer of bad things and a bearer of evil spirits behind it.
I'm just reading of these, the guys you were speaking of earlier, these two guys in Arizona. Supposedly they had a picture of this thing posted in the newspaper, the epitaph. And,
yep. And Tombstone, actually, the Tombstone epitaph.
Yeah, exactly, in Tombstone, Arizona. So I know a lot of drinking went on then, especially in 1890. My thought is there's got to be an existing issue somewhere to verify, to look at, see what the heck this thing is. It says they pinned it with its wings outstretched across the entire length of a barn. Of course, a barn could be any size you want it to, but...
And I believe you should be able to, if you Google image that, you might be able to actually get the image. I stepped away from my computer for a moment. When I get back to it, I'll see if I can find it. I have seen that picture before, looking over some cryptozoology stuff with from another time a few years back.
Yeah, I did find a picture here. I don't know if...
And if I remember correctly, it's just like all our really good ghost ones. It's fuzzy and hard to make out.
Oh, this one's not 1890. This one's 1980. Looks like a giant crow, if you ask me. I think somebody took a crow and photoshopped it.
Oh, and that, yeah, and anything's possible and can be done. Not now.
We got the stumbled on the Monster of Elizabeth Lake. I've never heard of that one.
Oh, I never heard of that one either. Who knows?
Yeah.
But that kind of, I guess...
It has bat wings, the neck of a giraffe, the head of a bulldog, six legs, a length of at least 50 feet, and emits a horrible, nauseating stench.
Don't they all? You know that a Bigfoot had a bad stench? I bet you if we researched more into all these other mythical creatures, they probably would all say how they smell bad. I don't know, the other one, I don't want to talk about it a whole lot tonight because we touched on it for a good amount of time last week was, of course, the Chupacabra, and that obviously falls well into the realm of cryptozoology, being an animal that's unknown and unseen, yet still ravishes around and sucks the blood out of chickens. But one that we kind of did talk about last week, where we just touched on it briefly, was... the river monster, or not river monsters, lake monsters. And, you know, you have the legend of Loch Ness. You have Champ of Lake Champlain. And there's one, I remember, I think you said one out somewhere in the western part of the United States. The other one I was able to find was actually out in western, I want to say Vancouver, up in Canada. And let me pull it up real quick. The name of the lake escaped me, and now my internet just crashed, so never mind. So, you know, these creatures have now, besides just being cryptozoological creatures and something of great debate and study, are now tourist attractions. You go to Loch Ness, and I'm sure even up in Champlain, you can get... you know, stuffed animals of Nessie, stuffed animals of Champ. You know, they have tours out on, you know, chartered boats to go out and look for them. And now, this almost kind of jumps into your debate with Bigfoot. You know, if he's out there, why don't you use all this high-tech equipment to get it? This is what they're doing now out in Loch Ness. I mean, they're using these gigantic sonar devices to try and hunt down Nessie. I don't know if they've really gone to the same extent in Lake Champlain that they do at Loch Ness, but they certainly have gone that extent in their small submersible, you know, submarines, you know, these giant boats with sonar nets trying to hunt this creature down, and they continuously get the same kind of half-assed evidence. You know, it could be it, but it could also be a log on the bottom of the lake.
Yeah, so, like, send something down there and find out, you know.
Yeah, I think, you know, they're doing the best they could. I mean, they got the little submarines, things with cameras attached to them to try and find it, and they continuously, time after time, are coming up, you know, with nothing solid, but, you know, there's a few of them where they say, look, it looks like we were just brushed by something, and they have a, you know, it looks like a fin going by them at a high speed, you know, but it could also be a large sturgeon. That's one of the big critics of the monster of Loch Ness and Champ is that there are actually fish in these lakes. I mean, these lakes are gigantic lakes, miles and miles long. Lake Champlain is 400 feet deep. Fish grow to the size of their environment. A small pond won't grow a trout that real big, but a big lake will. And same thing with these gigantic lakes, they have gigantic fish. So it is very possible that, you know, it could be a big sturgeon that's somehow surfacing and just appears to be like a weird mythical dinosaur surfacing off the water.
If it was a fish, I could see where it would come up and jump and you might see one hump. How do you explain three and four humps coming up through the water, you know?
Well, I guess their big debate on that is...
a whole school of them.
I guess, well, they're saying it's just an eye trick. It's your eyes playing tricks on you, is what it is. You know, these lakes, unlike the small lakes and ponds that I'm used to going to and swimming in, they have tides and, you know, sometimes, waves up to, you know, a foot tall. These waves could be breaking off in the distance, and then if you look at them, they'll actually appear to be, have three or four humps coming out of the water.
I've often wondered if it was mind tricks, you know, the same mind tricks that people get that make women look better at closing time than they did at opening. So I wonder how much of it's liquid mind tricks.
Well, you never know, but I guess that's when you have to actually go back
We got a caller in here if you want to let him come in here.
Absolutely.
Area code 207, who we got here?
Yes, that's me. My name is John, I'm from Maine, and I wanted to... commend you on the radio show that you guys have got going. It's really a fairly large question with the Loch Ness monster pictures that are out there, especially one that's of afar, and you can see like three large humps poking out of the water. It's really fascinating. I also wanted to refer you to a really awesome site that we just finished off. That contains a wealth of information on any paranormal topic you can dream of. Well, not every single paranormal topic, but we have over almost 500 different categories, and for cryptozoology, we have a whole bunch of articles. Mystical creatures, we have 1,354 articles, and these are documents. They're not like home pages or just like little tiny websites that are designed to promote groups and all these things. There are strict documents that contain information. It's called paranormal51.com. I don't know if you've heard of it, but you may want to check it out. We just finished it off last month, and we'd like to get the word out about our site. Have you visited it yet?
I haven't yet, but I am right now, actually.
Me too.
Did you mention it? I wish I knew this was here earlier, because if you had a lot of the stuff about cryptids in there, I'm sure this would have been part of my favorites that I usually do when I research for a show. And a lot of it ends up usually being Wikipedia, or like today was cryptozoology.com. I tab them in my favorites, and I pull them up as we're doing the show here, and pull them off. If I saw a lot of this here, I'm sure this would have been tabbed, and some of the information in here I probably would have been most likely would have been pulling off of here and mentioning it, you know, especially when we go off the topics that I'm not familiar with, cryptozoology being one of them. I'm remotely familiar with it, but it's like I always say, ghosts and hauntings are my specialty. So,
yes. It's a fascinating topic. I almost felt like I had a sledgehammer hit me on the side of a face when I was when I just returned from a graveyard. It was really quite a disheartening experience.
It's a very weird feeling, isn't it? Just if you were listening earlier when I was talking about the first time I was touched, you don't want, you're not really so much scared, but I still really don't know how to put words to it. The way that my body and my mind reacted to the circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Understood. Oh yeah. Well, we're building our database each and every day. The most powerful feature of our website is that we categorize our website. So if you want to see articles that relate to aliens and the Loch Ness Monster and the alien connection, if there is one, you know, you just click off the checkbox for aliens and Loch Ness Monster, and you'll get all the documents that contain the requisites for meeting the criteria of being a Loch Ness Monster and alien document. So,
do you have anything on the link between aliens and the U.S. presidency?
And the U.S. presidency? Say again?
So I was wondering if you had anything on links between the aliens and the U.S. president.
Oh, yes. In fact, we more than likely do. Absolutely. All you need to do is just get to the ultimate search page, which we're considering removing the charge, but it only costs 99 cents per month. You can just pay for it through PayPal or whatnot, or you can register for your free 24-hour trial. It's that simple, but let me see how many documents we have on U.S. presidents and aliens for you just in a moment.
Because that would explain a lot, especially about what's going on in Washington now.
Yeah. Completely. I totally agree.
We got about 5 minutes left here.
Okay. Well, I will... would you like me to take off and let you guys close out the show or whatnot, or?
I'm pretty good. I don't really have much to say in closing, so we got another minute or two. I only got about a minute worth of closing to do, so.
Okay, I'm finding out for you how many articles we have relating aliens and government and military. We don't have U.S. presidents because I thought I'd protect the presidency in respect to that. But I'm using and or for combined categories. And the search, and we'll see how many we get. We have like close to 5,000 different articles in there, there should be some that relate UFOs and government and military and aliens.
Now that's handy. This webpage I'll have to remember. That's for sure.
It's fairly powerful. There's no other more powerful website. It's the most powerful paranormal website that I have ever seen. And I've scoured the entire internet looking for anything that comes close to what our site contains.
Yeah, that'll be cool because I get off on some weird angles sometimes, you know, the link between Mickey Mouse and Bigfoot or something. So it'll be cool to be able to...
Oh, yeah. Totally.
Well, in Florida, if it was the Mickey Mouse in Florida, it wouldn't be Bigfoot. It'd be the Skunk Ape. You got to remember that.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. No, I was thinking California.
All right. Well, then that could probably be Bigfoot.
Okay, well, I'll let you guys close it out. I know the time is up, but for some reason, our database is not churning out that information. We don't have anything because it's on a different... subcategory. That's the reason why. Let me check if there's a different one underneath aliens.
All right,
government and military. There we go. One second.
5 minutes.
Sorry about that.
No problem. got to make sure you come back next week and join us. We're going to have a Wild West theme next week.
Awesome.
This should be a lot of fun. It's going to be different. I'm debating whether I want to throw some curveball questions into the host or into the guests or not, you know, about ghosts and hauntings, or if I just want to sit back and let them tell their stories, because I'm sure those will be just interesting to hear as anything else.
You're going to have your hands full, because Kathleen Lane is done about everything. She was, if you remember the movie Serpico, about the detective Frank Serpico. Well, she was number two in line, I guess, behind him. So she's done that. She's done ghost investigations, ghost tours. She's a civil rights lawyer. She's a living historian, a Wild West reenactor. She's a psychic. She's a medical intuitive. She's about everything. So
maybe
throw your curveballs at her.
Maybe she can tell me what's wrong with me.
Okay, we have 546 different articles about aliens, and that have government and military aspects of in the articles itself. So they're both about aliens and government and military. So 546 of them. Yeah. So
we'll have to do our homework and come up with some different themes for shows here, I guess.
I know as time goes on, we're going to have to hit the UFO and alien subject, so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for information, we'd like to be your number one resource, so I hope to hear from you.
Absolutely.
And,
appreciate
and
you
thanks
letting
for,
us know.
Thanks for taking my call.
Anytime.
No problem.
Okay. All right, have a good evening.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
All right. Well, I must say that. I got to say, this show went very well tonight. I'm pretty pleased with it. At this point, we have now tripled our all-time caller number.
We're going to go for a record next week.
I know. If we can quadruple it, we'll even better. Any information anybody ever wants, Haunted America Radio, blogtalkradio.com/haunted. Obviously, you know that because you are listening. I hope everybody listens next week at the same time, 7 p.m. on Sunday. And Al's already pretty much covering what we're talking about. I'm pretty excited about these next 2 weeks. I'm really excited about the 2 weeks from now with the
Paul Rademacher is the executive director of the Monroe Institute and also an author of Spiritual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, which I just started reading it, but I'll tell you, it starts off right at the beginning. He was a Presbyterian minister for 15 years, and he quit the church because what he was finding out, the truth about the afterlife, didn't seem to match up with what the church was telling him. So that's going to be an interesting show.
That's going to be really good because that's the topic I'm going to really be able to sink my teeth into. I throw this plug out every night, though, or any more information you want about me, or my group or the investigations we've conducted, you know, always visit at BerkshireParanormal.com or HoughtonMansion.com, anything about the Houghton Mansion, which I usually refer to at least once a night, tours, sleepovers, haunted buildings. You can also find me on MySpace and Facebook. Just Google search my name, or just search my name on them, Josh Mantello, and you can find me on MySpace and Facebook. On there, I got my full bio for any information. We're always available for public speaking, lectures, anything along those lines. If anybody ever would like to have us come out and not just hear us over the computer.
Yep, very good. And I got to plug myself here too. Only I do mine with commercials. But anyways, I'm my own home-based business, and I'm going to start doing home parties. I'm trying a new thing for this. So anybody wants to know what I'm doing, how I work from home, join me on Twitter, NCOGNITO66, Incognito66, and I'll shoot you some info. All right, we got to get out of here. Time's about up, so. We'll catch everyone back here next week. Have fun, Josh. Say hi to your sweetie for me.
Radio is brought to you by
Send Out Cards, one of the most unique, exciting, and fastest growing home-based business opportunities available today. It all revolves around a unique service. Send Out Cards offers an online system that allows you to log in from anywhere in the world, type a message, and click the send button. The company then actually prints a physical greeting card in your handwriting with your signature and mails it to your recipient in the mailbox, all for under $1. You can even add a gift and have it sent along with your greeting card. It's easy, it's quick, and it's something anybody can do. You can become a customer of Send Out Cards, but you may also select our entrepreneur option, which gives you the ability to participate in our compensation plan and create a residual side income stream for yourself and your family, all while working part-time around your already busy schedule. Try out a free gift account. They'll show you all the cool features of the Send Out Card system, and you can actually send out a few cards yourself. If at that time you still like what you see, welcome to the Send Out Cards team.
If you'd like more information on this amazing system, visit www.sendoutcardsofvermont.com. That's www.sendoutcardsofvermont.com. Or call Alan at 802-733-5296 today.